Okay, I'm going to try to give you a brief and simple flavor for anelastic properties of materials. These are properties that are controlled by, again, by the microscopic scale behavior of materials, defects in particular, but they affect some very important macroscopic properties that we see: diffusion, viscosity, rheology, plastic rheology, attenuation. So what I'm going to do is, again, try to connect a microscopic scale picture now of defects with a little bit of a taste for some of the, or a flavor for some of the macroscopic scale properties that it controls. Okay. So just a brief behavior of where I'm coming from and where I'm not coming from. This is just the summary of the last lecture that I had given you, which is talking about elastic behavior, strain as a function of stress. And this is the we talked about how we can take the stress and strain and decompose it into a hydrostatic component and a deviatoric component, and that there was one elastic constant that we can associate with a hydrostatic, and then depending on the symmetry of the system, there are either one or many elastic components that we associate with a deviatoric component, which is all of the elastic information that's responsible for stress change. So here's a linear type relationship between stress and strain, which we know isn't true for the Earth. We actually have to consider finite strain. So, but this is still the elastic behavior between stress and then a resulting lattice strain. In the hydrostatic case, you can squeeze and squeeze and squeeze and squeeze. It's purely hydrostatic, and you'll keep going down here until you start to generate fusion or some basically, which is a very interesting realm of condensed matter physics and also planetary sciences, but not what we're talking about here. However, we can also substitute any stress constant or any stress direction and strain direction that we want in this picture, and we can also show the elasticity and the curvature, the slope of this line, or the slope of this line will be related to that elastic constant, how that elastic constant goes between the stress direction that we're measuring and the strain. But in practice, when we apply a shape-changing stress, eventually the material fails. It deforms plastically, and that's what we're going to investigate now. So a deviation from this plot. Okay, so here's our new plot of information. We have stress, strain, and I've backed off a finite strain definition, and now this is the linear portion of our stress strain curve, and this is just the purely elastic component. And now our stress and strain are not the hydrostatic component, but rather some deviatoric component. And right now I'm just going to talk about one component. So we're applying perhaps a shear stress or uniaxial stress. And here's the elastic component. And then at some point, what happens, and this is empirically known, is that as we increase the stress, the material strains a lot more than it did, okay, before. So it breaks with the initial elasticity slope. Okay. And then if we pull it even more, kaboom, our material breaks and fractures. And that's what those little X's are referring to. Now we can do this as a function of temperature, and we find that the material actually is even more plastic. It deforms a lot more for a given increment of stress, and it probably breaks at a much higher total strain. We can also change the strain rate and find that there's less deformation for a unit amount of stress, and again, we'll probably be able to extend for longer before we break. So there's a series of this information that we can collect empirically on many different materials under many different conditions, and it will tell us something about these defect behavior. Okay. Now before I go on, I want to touch on some definitions briefly, mostly because people who work in this business blow steam out of their ears if you use a wrong definition for these three terms. One is strength. It doesn't really mean anything by itself, and what's usually referred to is something called a yield strength. And that has very specific definitions depending on the geometry. But basically, the yield strength is the amount of stress that you give to a material before it starts to plastically deform. Okay, so the yield strength is defined by this on that plot. Okay? So there's a definition for strength of a material, or yield strength of a material. How much elastic stress can it support before it fails plastically? Okay, so that's one definition. The second one that's often confused with strength is hardness. Okay, hardness is a completely different thing. Hardness is once a material is plastically deforming, how much stress does it take to increase the plastic deformation? So you can think of it perhaps as it's a slope on this plot. And it's actually calibrated in a very specific way. You drop a load that's known on a material, and you wait for a certain amount of time, and then you lift the load, and you look at the plastic indentation that it's created. So it completely ignores this elastic part, because if we load at a certain rate and unload, we'll get back to here, and then when we measure this difference in strain, that's a measure of a material's hardness. It's absolutely time dependent, and that's why they're very ASTM comes out with a very series of very strict criteria for what the load has to be, how long it's on, and then measurement. So it's definitely comparative property, and it changes. I mean, it changes with temperature, it changes with load. I mean, it's very much a function of a material's previous history, especially. Yield strength, you might be able to argue, it might not be as much of a function of the history, but hardness is very much a function of history. And in fact, in general, all of these plastic deformation processes are a big function of a material's history. They're not an intrinsic material property like its elasticity. Okay. And finally, there's another thing that you also wouldn't want to confuse with strength or hardness, and that's toughness. And toughness would probably be interesting if you're working on rock mechanics at the surface or earthquake faults. And the definition for toughness is an energy criterion. It's the amount of energy that it takes to propagate a crack through a material once the crack is established. Okay, so it's an energy is a fracture toughness of the material. And again, there's a whole series of testing definitions for how you initiate your crack and the type of, you know, kaboom that you give it in order to propagate the crack through. Okay. So we can actually take a look at these properties in our hands again, and I'll pass out some more office supplies. You just take one and pass it along. And then here's some for this side too. Okay, so most of this work was done on metals in the 19th century. In the early part of the 20th century. So metals are very nice models for us to actually be able to get a physical sense of how these material properties work. Okay, so when you take the paper clip, try to find a place that hasn't been bent yet, so one of your straight areas, okay? And then give a feel for the elastic properties, okay? So you can actually bend it a little bit and it'll spring back. That's the elastic behavior. A material, an earth material is like, you know, if perovskites got an elastic moduli of, you know, 200 to 300 GPA, this is about half that. So it's actually not that different. Okay, but it's on the same, you know, it's within an order of magnitude. Okay, so this is the elasticity of a material. Okay, now you could bend it and you let go and it, you get a kink in it. Okay? Try to remember how that feels in your hand, because this is going to count. Okay, there you've just plastically deformed your paper clip. Okay, so you can go through here, and then you can feel this bending. Okay, now you could bend it back, and the next time you bend it back, you might find that it's a little harder to bend the second time around. Okay, so what would that would look like, I didn't put this on this chart, is it would look like this increasing, okay? Or basically every time you bend, the slope of this second part of the line will be increasing, okay? So your hardness is actually increasing as you bend it back and forth. Now, I counted about 10 times. We'll take, and then you should fracture it. Yeah? Can you, is it heating?
Well, I know that you take wire and bend it back and forth a lot, and it heats up pretty quickly.
Yeah, I tried it. I couldn't sense it. Like, I did the rubber band test on it. But yeah, there is a temperature effect. And actually, right before it breaks, you might have found that your, that it kind of went, you gave it a lot of strain. It was very easy to bend all of a sudden. That's right before failure. Anyway, this is what's happening to a material. Okay. Okay, so now let's ask, well, what's happening at the microscopic scale in that piece of steel? And I think a couple lucky people had little brass clips also. They're easier to play with. Okay, so we're going to go back to our balls. So we have a ball model for a metal. And in this case, this is steel. It's a little more complicated than that. The paper clip probably has large iron balls, and they're probably not closed packed like that, but they're body center cubic, and they probably have about 0.6% of carbon interstitially in here, complicating everything. That's why they're so brittle. That's why they broke. But let's just back off. We'll assume that we have a very simple metal consisting of closed packed spheres. Okay? And then we're going to ask the question, okay, well, we're going to come up with a model, okay? What kind of stresses do I need to use to bend this thing plastically? And so here's our first order model. We have our material. I only fixed it at this end because it was just easier to do, and we're going to apply a stress now, which is a kind of a shear stress, in this direction. And what we're going to look at is this atom plane here. What we're going to do is we're going to take the whole top half of this material and we're going to slide it against the bottom half. Okay, so you can see it like this. Actually, it wouldn't come back, so I put it back. And now we're going to ask, how much stress do we need to do that? Okay? So this is a classic question. So I call the stress that we need to do that T, and it's proportional to G, which is actually our shear modulus, okay, so this is our elastic modulus, times the distance that we push it over divided by this distance here, okay? So we're pushing this in that direction, and we're separating that distance. But now you can imagine the different spheres now kind of bump up against each other. So we can't push it directly in that direction, but actually this kind of has to travel up and down and up and down and up and down or slide past each other. Okay? So we have this distance-dependent component to that stress that is the stress that it takes to move the spheres over each other in our model. Okay? So when we combine them, we get a description of the amount of stress that's necessary to move as we're sliding our upper row over the bottom row. So we need stress to move it up, and then when it goes down into its next door neighbor position, it doesn't need any stress again. So it increases and decreases in that sinusoidal function. Okay. B is the diameter. It's actually one. Yeah, but actually 2 pi over b. So yeah, so it's a diameter. So so the critical shear stress is the maximum stress that it takes right when you're at the top of that ball to move it. Yep.
It's not clear to me that when you look at this kind of microscopic view, then you actually feel the word microscopic and the concept.
Okay, that's a really good point, and you're going to see exactly what happens next. I mean, this is a model that was developed probably in the late 19th century to try to explain strength of materials. And the paradox was that when you actually go to measure strength of materials, it's a lot lower than what's predicted by the theoretical model by two and more orders of magnitude. So the whole formulation is wrong. It's a first order model for what would happen if you tried to take a row of atoms and slide it across the surface. And that's the most simplified model. I mean, you could do it in a more sophisticated way, but you wouldn't really change the answer very much from that. The truth is, when you actually go to measure the strength of a material, and this happened with metals, and here's the picture of Corrado's work on a series of earth materials, the true strength, okay, the amount of stress that it takes to plastically deform a material, is orders of magnitude less than this ideal strength that you can calculate from that model of planes of atoms moving across each other. So that was really the point of that exercise, is to show how a model with a wrong assumption that might not take into account the details of microscopic behavior of materials will lead you down a completely wrong path. Okay? So because of this, a group of independent researchers in 1934 hypothesized the existence of a dislocation in a material. And this was a hypothetical defect that allowed you to move one row of atoms in a better way across the other row of atoms. So the hypothesis, actually looked like this. Okay, in which there's a defect now at the structure, and instead of the whole row of top atoms moving against the whole row of lattice planes on the bottom, that this defect propagates its way slowly through the structure, okay, kind of like an inchworm inching along until the whole top is propagated. Now, this was a very nice model because they can describe the amount of stress that it takes to deform a material, and they could describe a stress field around the dislocation and therefore make some predictions about how materials will deform under different conditions. And these tests were confirmed by observations. However, nobody had ever seen an actual dislocation, and I guess in the early 30s, and this would have been the metallurgy community, they were quite reluctant to believe in something that they couldn't see or observe. So this, you know, this was probably at the same time that quantum mechanics was just coming out into the open. I don't know, to what extent they knew about what was happening there. But there were huge arguments that they couldn't see the dislocations. And so it was finally after the transmission electron microscope was invented, 30 or 40 years later, I think this was early 60s, around maybe 50s, when the transition electron microscope was invented, that people were actually able to image dislocations, therefore confirming the theory that explains so much. So here are some images of dislocations from the transmitted electron microscope of wadsleyite, which is a transition zone mineral, and all of these dark lines, they're actually kind of squiggly in this picture. Here's some nice straight ones, and they're tangled together. And here are some more images of dislocations. These are these one-dimensional defects going through the structure. Okay. I don't know what the sense of shear is in this case. At all. A couple things, though. One of the points is the strain hardening that you felt. Did anybody feel it? Okay, so as you tried to bend When you bent your paperclip the first time, well, first, a pristine, unbent piece of metal would look like a nice, clear film in this picture with almost no dislocations. Okay, the energy that it takes to generate scores of dislocations is the same type of energy that you're putting in when you just start to plastically deform your material. So as you bend it, you create more dislocations. Now remember, the dislocations have their own stress fields. They interact with each other. So as the dislocations tangle up and impede each other's glide through the material, you get a material that becomes harder. Okay, and that's called strain hardening. And it's the basis for most of our engineering materials, or many of our engineering materials are actually manufactured this way. Okay, so I'm glad you asked about which is the sense of strain of dislocations, because the dislocations have a rotational component to them. And in fact, I think we actually had heard it during one of the lectures, that when you propagate a dislocation through a material, it can create a lattice preferred orientation, that is, dislocation motion, or some kinds of rheology, or defect controlled creep, orient olivine in certain directions. So I can show you how that happens with more office supplies. Let me see. Sorry about that. Okay, here it is. So you can almost see it in this picture, where you're propagating through, okay, and you get a shear movement, or a movement of this part of the crystal with respect to that part. So actually there's a row now of atoms that are hanging off the edge here. Okay, so you can do the same thing with post-it notes. This is what happens, by the way, when you deprive an earth scientist of field work. They have to go to the office to do it. So we have post-it notes, which are really nice because they can shear. And remember that the actual dislocation isn't a sliding of post-it notes, but it's actually a propagation of a, you know, kind of a tube from one end to the other. But we can take this whole deck of cards or post-it notes and shear it. Okay? But I like the post-it notes because they're all constrained on this side. Now we can imagine that this is one crystal in a whole polycrystalline array of materials. So this side has a boundary condition, okay, a welded boundary condition, that it sticks next to this side here, okay? So when I shear this without the boundary condition, it tilts towards that way. But now when I apply the constraint by its nearest neighbor, this has to stick to some extent, although all the crystals have to move together, it becomes a lot more complicated. And so this will actually rotate in this direction. Okay? You can see that the dislocation movement was this way, and the rotation was this way. Okay? So what I get from that is it's not a completely straightforward story to say which way a rotation is going to occur when you have a dislocation. What we can say is that dislocations are most likely to occur along planes that are densely packed and along planes that are densely packed and then with the next, with the dislocation, the distance between the two planes being the furthest spaced apart. Okay, so that will provide a good prediction of how the structure will tell you about how the dislocation will occur. Okay, so dislocations are quantified by something called the Burgers vector. And I did this from remembering. Here's the core of the dislocation now looking down in three dimensions. It's called a one-dimensional defect because it consists of a series of point defects arranged along a line in this direction. And in this case, if we applied a shear stress in this direction, we would move this across that way to the right. To define the Burgers vector of your dislocation, you start at the core, and then you travel around in a square. You go east, south, west, north. And if you're not back to where you were, you know that you're at a dislocation, and then the vector that takes you from where you are to where you started is defined as the Burgers vector. It's simple in this, but there are other kinds of dislocations called screw dislocations, which are created by shearing in the vertical direction. I don't have a nice picture of that. Okay. We'll come back to dislocations later. But for now, I want to briefly talk about point defects in materials. Point defects in materials are equilibrium defects, that is, the presence of no defects raises the energy of the crystal so much that when you add a tiny amount of defects, it automatically lowers the energy. So they exist in equilibrium in a crystal, and they're temperature dependent. Okay. So that also means that you can write out a complete thermodynamic treatment of a point defect. So a single component material can be thought of as a binary, for example, in this case, a salt of some type with point defects alloyed in. Okay. So there are three basic types of point defects. You can have a vacancy in which you pull an atom from your structure out. You can take either one of the atoms that are in there. You can take an atom that's already in the structure and put it in a different position. That would be an interstitial. Or you can take an impurity and replace it into your structure. And that's a substitutional point defect. When we have earth materials that are the first order ionics, then we have to worry about the constraints on the defects. And the first one is that they have to maintain charge neutrality. So there's never a single vacancy. There's always either a coupled dual vacancy of, or however many it takes to maintain charge balance, or a coupled interstitial and vacancy, as long as charge balance is maintained in the whole system. So that places this charge balance constraint on the thermodynamics, and so it gets more complicated. I'm not going to derive the energetics for diffusion, because you've probably seen it done in some diffusion class. Does everybody take a diffusion class? Maybe not. But the probability or the rate of creation of a vacancy or the number of vacancies is controlled by a Boltzmann distribution. Okay, so we have the diffusion constant is a pre-exponential term times an energy term that consists of the activation energy for creating a point defect plus a work term that it takes for a defect divided by RT. So I thought that I would show some of the diffusion constants for earth materials that have been measured and show a diffusion constant, so this is in meters squared per second, as a function of temperature. Actually, it's inverse temperature. So this is called an Arrhenius plot. The relationship is linear, and the slope of this plot gives you the activation energy, and as you do it at different pressures, it gives you a pressure dependence, so the difference between the slope and the slope. So you can see that different materials have different D-naughts, and their activation energies are different. So garnet has a much higher activation energy, so it's steeper on this Arrhenius plot. Pardon me? Oh my goodness. Okay, so most of these are cation self-diffusion within the minerals. So of the major elements. So the so that's MgFe in most cases, and I don't actually remember about the garnet, but I know for these that it's the major element cations. We can also ask a question. What's the diffusion of platinum through these materials? What's the diffusion? So that would be just different ways in setting up the experiment. Bruce mentioned that we've been talking a little bit about time and space scales here, but these diffusion constants give you a hint as to how quickly materials can chemically equilibrate by completely diffusing with their surroundings. And you can formulate an approximation to the diffusion equations, and that gives you a relationship between the time that it takes for a material to equilibrate with its neighbors, given its diffusivity or its diffusion constant, and its width. So I calculated for this 1 centimeter droplet of iron raining through the mantle, if it has a diffusion coefficient of around 10 to the minus 12, 1 centimeter droplet will take about 3 years to equilibrate. Whereas if we have now a subducting slab of material going through, or even, let's say, the topmost kilometer of material going through a mantle, a kilometer worth of material will take 10 to the 10 years, so 10 billion years to equilibrate. So these diffusion coefficients really control the chemical transport of materials. Yeah, they're solids. Mm-hmm. Yeah, liquids are faster. Okay, so we've talked about one-dimensional defects, zero-dimensional defects, and now I just want to talk briefly about grain boundaries. They're much more difficult to deal with. There's very, very little theory or even ways to quantify the behavior at the boundary, but you can imagine where two very different materials come together, or where the same material in very different orientations come together, that they'll create a very different structure at the grain boundary. And so here's a picture that just came out in Nature 2004. And this is another transmission electron microscope view now of a grain boundary. I don't remember what it is. If it's olivine, it's olivine, right? Okay. And so we have now, almost at the atomic level, a picture of what's exactly happening at the grain boundary. The contrast that you see in the transmission electron microscope isn't so easy to interpret. It's not as simple as an optical microscope, for example, and it's definitely not as simple as a scanning electron microscope where you see surface topology, or in backscatter mode where you get chemical information. And this is a very complicated process of electron diffracting through a material. But to first order, these are the rows, these are the lattice planes of atoms lining up in one grain orientation, and here are the lattice planes lining up in a second orientation. And the point for this paper is a really, really important point. What they did was they did a point-by-point qualitative chemical look across this boundary, and they found the behavior inside the boundary, well, first of all, to be very different from the adjacent, but also to pool elements that don't necessarily like to be in the bulk of the material. So it's a receptacle for materials. And the other point about grain boundaries is because the structure, first of all, is not as compact. Second of all, it's a higher energy structure, that the diffusivities of materials through this grain boundary structure, okay, so now this is a surface grain boundary effect, is orders of magnitude faster than it is through the bulk material. So grain boundaries can control a lot of the mass transport behavior of a material. Okay, so let's put it together and take a look at the different types of controls that we have on mass transport in earth materials. So what I've done is I've put up a big table that talks about which defect is controlling the mass transport. I give you some names for the mass transport mechanism, and then talk about its dependencies. on stress and strain rate, grain size, temperature, and whether or not it can cause a lattice preferred orientation. Okay. So diffusion creep is controlled by bulk diffusion through the properties. It's called Navarro-Herring creep. And the activation energy for the diffusion is large, so that there's a very strong dependence on temperature. When you have a large activation energy like that, the diffusion processes are very slow. They're not controlling at low temperature. But as you go to higher temperatures, the diffusion processes start taking over. Grain boundary mechanisms are also related to diffusion, but this time it's diffusion through a grain boundary, which is orders of magnitude faster. So it has the same strong dependence on temperature, but now we've introduced a very strong dependence on grain size. So if we have very, very large grains, we're going to have bulk diffusion take over at high temperatures, whereas the grain boundary diffusion just won't be able to play as much of a role. Whereas if they're very small grains, the grain boundary diffusion will take over everything at high temperatures, while the diffusion won't be able to keep up. Okay? Less so, until you start getting to the nanoscale, where the volume becomes, well, when the surface area becomes a significant component of the whole volume, even for micron-sized grains, you're still volume controlled. So it's not as much of a dependence. I mean, there's some. Okay, now dislocations, remember, these are materials, when we propagate a dislocation through a material, it actually takes quite a bit of stress to push the dislocation through. So dislocation glide is called power law creep, because of its macroscopic manifestation of its rheology. And it's very, very strongly stress dependent and strain rate dependent. It's more or less independent of grain size, and it's weakly dependent on temperature, mostly because the activation energies to propagate a dislocation are lower than those to propagate a defect. Yeah. I don't know where it comes from. I think I wrote it down because I've heard that term being used. I don't know the history of it. I'm assuming it's just that the plasticity, the sheer, I mean, the strain rates of grain boundary creep could be just a lot higher than other values. But I don't know. It's just a guess. Yeah. Okay, so dislocation glide is very strongly dependent on stress. So when we have larger stresses and lower temperatures, dislocation glide is probably going to be the predominant mechanism. Okay, so in our everyday experience of plastic deformation of materials, dislocation glide probably provides, is controlling the paperclip behavior, for example. And there are also arguments that it controls upper mantle and also crustal behavior of materials. And it creates very strong lattice preferred orientations depending on the, well, strong lattice preferred orientations. And then if the material is elastically anisotropic, you might be able to detect that orientation. Dislocation climb, I've included, because this takes over, it's a dislocation mechanism that takes over at higher temperatures. Dislocation glide is a propagation of the dislocation sideways, and dislocation climb occurs when you actually have this line of defects diffusing as a group upward. So the whole dislocation climbs. It's not going to rotate the crystal, and it takes a lot of energy for it to happen, so this takes over at higher temperatures.
Mm-hmm. It still happened to be temperature dependent on. And I thought the reason for that was the lines can only go so far before they get kind of hung up, and you've got to get the climbs. So, in other words, these two often go together.
Dislocation, climb, and glide? Yep.
You ultimately have something
That's right. That's right. Yeah, the dislocation climb should be temperature. It is strongly temperature dependent. Yeah. Yeah.
You would have a temperature dependence in your power law creep because you require a climb at some point here.
That's right. That's right. Right. But the activation energy for climb is a lot higher than for glide. So what happens is that they cross over. It shouldn't be linear on this scale, but this is glide and climb. Let's just call this a rate, some rate of defect propagation. Okay, the point that I want to make here, and then when you're able to print out this table, maybe it'll give you a handy-dandy reference to first of all, to see the different languages that's used in the macroscopic definition of the flow laws, to connect it up with the microscopic properties that are controlling that mass transport. But the last point that I want to make is what we can measure in the laboratory, and also what we might see with seismic attenuation, or the inelastic component of seismic attenuation, happens in a regime that's more controlled by dislocation motion, happens in a very high stress, relatively low temperature, high strain rate regime. Whereas the bulk controls on especially lower mantle rheology are very high temperature, low strain rate mechanisms that take over. So we can show this in table form, but a convenient way of showing it is as a map that consolidates all of the information on one plot. So this is shear stress. So this is our stress. Here's our temperature. And now it's relative to the melting temperature so that several materials are scaled. Shear stress, temperature, I think that these are strain rate contours. And then we have small, medium, and large. This is centimeter size, grain sizes. This deformation map is for ice, and that's a material people have done a lot of work on. One reason we have very good constraints, both in the laboratory and then also for relatively slow strain rates in glacial flow. But it turns out, when I looked and compared with olivine, that you don't have to shift this axis by more than an order of magnitude, and it looks almost identical. So it's very similar types of regimes that control these materials. So low temp, diffusion at low stresses, and then we have dislocation motion up at high stresses, and then different bulk diffusion takes over at high temperatures compared to the grain boundary control at lower temperatures. So this is how our information is for rock rheology and deformation is presented on a plot. Okay. Of this one exactly? I forgot to write it down.
Frost and Ashby.
Not that one, not the ice one. I mean, Frost and Ashby compiled a lot of them. I think it might be Bill Durham because he's done a lot of the ice rheology, but I don't know if it's that. Okay, so it's already a complicated and difficult story, but I want to point out three factors that add another order of difficulty. The first one is dynamic recrystallization. That is, as you put in shear energy into a crystal, as you deform it, as you build up entangled dislocations, there's a driving force for it to driving force and available energy for it to nucleate and grow a clean, relatively defect-free crystal. that driving force increases as you increase the temperature, and it increases as you increase the amount of total deformation, total plastic deformation that the material's experienced. So my picture of the mantle is modified by a picture of grains as they deform, of nucleating small crystals and growing clean, undeformed crystals at the expense of very, very deformed crystals. So this is happening as material is undergoing deformation and mass transport in the Earth. The second complication is the effect of water. Empirically, all of the mass transport rates increase significantly when you add water. So it softens everything, is another way of saying it. All of those mechanisms, but especially ones that are grain boundary controlled. So the presence of water, probably because it helps consolidate very different materials at the boundary and creates a very different high diffusivity grain boundary regime, changes the rheology significantly. However, that's just going to increase deformation and therefore perhaps increase the effects in the end of dynamic recrystallization. So they're coupled in together. Yeah, Brent?
Can you give me an idea of how much water you actually need? Like, what's the, at what point in time can you say that it's dry?
Yeah. That's a really good question. I think it depends on how you're asking the question. If you want to ask, how much water do I have to add to change the elastic constants? The answer is a couple percent and it's dry. If you're asking, how much water do I need to change a bulk melting property? The answer would be 0.5%. If you're asking, at what point does a teeny weeny surface layer of melt come out at the grain boundary, whereas I wouldn't see the effects necessarily in a bulk melt extraction, but I would see it absolutely in the rheology, I think the answer is on the hundreds of ppm level. I don't know.
This one of the scary things about rheology in general is very fine things. You have very large
differences.
And to continue your list, the question is, how much does it take to significantly affect the viscosity? And the answer is, of course, the money.
Right.
And sure, CO2 probably has a big effect too, but I think well characterized.
Right. Yeah, I don't. Water's special in some ways because it's so polar. It really. When it's at a surface, it changes the surface and everything near the surface. CO2, not as much. And I really think it's that polar quality to water that controls those very surface effects. And my guess would be not as much. Oh, and the last complication is strain rate extrapolation. That is, in the laboratory, we cannot approach within orders of magnitude the very low strain rates of the Earth. So all of our assumptions, our deformation maps, for example, we want to see our very low strain rates are down here. And you notice that, you know, we have many different regimes up here at higher strain rates, and we have just one blanket regime at low strain rates. And that means either that there is only one mechanism for transport that occurs at those low strain rates, that is a diffusion, or we don't know the mechanisms that might be occurring at these very, very low strain rates. So there's a big fundamental unknown. That's how I'll leave this. People are trying.
Yeah, but certainly not for props anyway. Mm-hmm. And the uncertainties are such that people are still arguing about whether dislocation glide or diffusion creep dominant.
That's right.
Even lower magnetic conditions, where the naively dependent strain rate's so low and the temperature's so high, it's got to be fusion. But within the uncertainties, people are still arguing.
That's right. Yeah. Even that first, yeah, that's right. And this was, this is definitely my, you know, personal bias. There's not, you know, a lot of facts to bolster it.
You have to see anisotropy of organic.
See, that's the thing is I actually wanted, I was really upset about this when I was making this chart. And so I looked for more evidence that these would create lattice preferred orientations or more mechanisms that might create a lattice preferred orientation. But I didn't like that there was only one mechanism that gives you lattice preferred orientation. I felt backed in the corner. I wanted more options. Right. Right, that's right.
Is there any reason when, let's come back to this post-perovskite business. Is there any way that you could actually preferentially align the crystal when you bring it through a phase transition? Is there any, so you have some crystal that you're starting with, maybe completely random, mm-hmm. push it through phase transition, some low rate. Is there any reason why you might tend to orient
Absolutely. And there are two types of ways to create a phase transformation. Okay, the first one is a shear type deformation where your structure is one and the whole thing pretty much at once collapses into a second structure. The second structure is going to have the same, if you have a polycrystalline array and all of the crystals go at the same time, the second structure is going to reflect any preferred orientation that existed in the first structure. The second way that you do a phase transformation is you nucleate and grow it, usually on a grain boundary. Okay? It's a slower process, it requires diffusion, it's thermally activated in a way that these diffusionless transformations are not. But in many cases, the orientation of that grain boundary will either help or hinder the energetics of the second phase. So when you have a second phase just growing from a first phase, there's a relationship between sometimes between the orientation, the crystal orientation of the second phase with respect to the first phase. So actually, for that second process, once it goes through to completion, you usually think of it as just recovering an isotropic state. But the first process might be able to retain a preferred orientation. Well, yeah, that's the type of diffusionless phase transformation that I was referring to. That will retain a preferred orientation. I think that the post-perovskite phase transformation. Well.
So you're thinking that if it's isotropic, it'll go through as the other phase, and it'll be isotropic.
Sure.
That's what I was thinking was, if you nucleated one grain, uh-huh. the extreme, right, nucleated one grain, the nucleation is so slow, and then it grows.
Oh, you nucleate a giant crystal?
And it grows expensive before anybody else can nucleate, so you've got some crystal.
That's unlikely, because it's a lot easier to nucleate than it is to grow under most circumstances. So usually a lot of nucleation, again, they're very sensitive to the presence of heterogeneity. It's sensitive to the temperature. It's sensitive to the undercooling, so the driving force. Like if you took a packet of stuff from the upper mantle and threw it down in the lower mantle, then you'd probably nucleate tons of materials. But if you took a very gently deformed material and very slowly brought it into its stable regime, then you would have a you would have larger crystals form. You know, I'm using all the, my metals knowledge, my knowledge about metallurgy to extrapolate to earth materials. They could be different. I don't know. But that's where my intuition comes from. Brass tacks. Well, when you, Mars might know more about this, but when you go through a phase transformation, by definition your shear modulus, so this is the elastic property, has to go to zero. I mean, you get a shear instability. Is that true for all or just for some types?
I don't think that would be a general
problem. Okay.
I thought it was. Structural weakness in the material just simply because you've got small grains, they would gradually grow, presumably, upon reach some sort of equilibrium where the growth rate was balanced by the production of new ones and that sort of thing. But I don't know what the status of that is in the models.
A couple of people, and there's some people that have included some super plastic layer of the transition zone and try to constrain its properties with GOE modeling. But
yeah.
And that what they actually was him. And people like David and others. I don't think that there's that much work recently, at least on the dynamical side. Well, part of it is doing texture and mental conduction.
Because Shun talked about some of this stuff. He talked about it in the context of the strength of the slab. As it goes through the phase transitions, you get different grain sizes, and you get very counterintuitive understandings of what the strength of the slab is. And your nominal intuition is that it's warmer on the outside and colder on the inside. I don't remember the details, but he was sort of got some funny business where the grain growth was different, and he got sort of weak interiors and strong insides,
right.
And all sorts of
right.
Funny things happen.
I mean, and the problem is that these defect properties count. I mean, they make a big difference. If you say, well, at the edges of my slab where I'm recrystallizing, you know, I'll have small grain sizes, and then we'll do a grain growth function that you could calculate and model. Even if you follow it, the logic and its implications, you'll get behavior that matters. But the actual constraints are few. I think. I really do.
I think we just come back to the dynamical effects. I think we just have to come back to the strain rates being so many orders of magnitude beyond
right.
What does it for years. And the fact that we have very, very, very long time scales to do dynamics. I mean, time scales of even 10 million years are a big deal, you know, in terms of being able to recrystallize stuff, overcome kinetics, you know, not to mention a billion years. So I've always been really very skeptical, including things like this. And
but it's possible but it's not impossible. I mean, the strain rates that are relevant to the mantle are not impossible in the lab. I mean, if you calculate, you know, for example, in the diamond cell, for a strain rate that's typical for the mantle, and then you ask, well, what's going to happen, you know, to a lattice plane? You know, can we deform a lattice plane and, for example, watch it relax on that kind of a strain rate, you know, a time space scale? I mean, you can actually do an experiment within a year that's pretty close. Well, I mean, you know, if anybody had a diamond cell that they were willing to, well, I mean, what you would have to do is find a way, first of all, I mean, it's not just strain rate. It's also really, really low shear stresses. It's mostly hydrostatic, okay? So if you were to find a way to be mostly hydrostatic, which I'd like to argue almost every experiment is, that the hydrostatic experiment would be the exception. So do a mostly hydrostatic experiment and wait a year or two. Well, go every 6 months and do a quick X-ray diffraction pattern.
It's kind of the same problem, isn't it? Because every diamond cell experiment that's ever been done has stresses, has DB-TORIC stresses that are larger than the ones in the mirror.
Even the hydrostatic experiments?
Absolutely.
Okay, so five orders of magnitude, not one order of magnitude. What?
I mean, some of these experiments by Shumkarato, where he's claiming these effects by water and these changes, can be
Well, his it's true. I mean, the regime that he's looking at is incredibly different from the Earth, which is why whenever he gives a talk, you should just ask, what about strain rate extrapolation? But you just, you know. But I mean, there's no answer to it, except for a hope that there are scaling relationships that you can apply. So the homologous temperature is very useful for that. Right.
Instead of watching it,
sure.
Looking at this angle jump.
Right.
You're
actually watching it move. Right. That's
something different.
It's not completely out of reach. I mean, the nice thing about X-ray diffraction is that you're looking at very, very small spatial scales. So some of what you lose when you're trying to do a macroscopic rheology, you know, in terms of your strain rate extrapolation, you gain back by looking at motions of individual lattice, you know, of a series of lattice planes. I mean, you're looking at sub-angstrom type distance scales. Yeah?
So I remember when I was in first year grad student, one of the, maybe it's an old wives tale, told to me that, and maybe one knows the answer, apparently Dave Mao has some, you know, sample of iron or something that new diamond cell at high pressure and have had it for the last 10, 20 years. And every so often he'll pull out a Exactly. Okay, so that's
it's real.
Yeah. So the story, right. So yeah, okay, so iron and a megabar.
So do it with perovskite.
Right. But I mean I was under the impression that he was only checking the pressure every now and again to make sure that it was stable. And I mean, to how we can measure pressure at 100 at a megabar or GPA, I think it's say constant. But I don't know, maybe he's putting an X-ray source every now and again. And you see the pressure could have been tested.
The Mao great rheology experiment, the longitudinal rheology experiment. I think it's possible.
I'm not claiming that it's impossible. I'm skeptical of making strong dynamical claims with the fact in mathematics.
Oh, well, making strong claims that something is a fact is very different from a feasible experiment. I mean, those are, right?
So
I mean, you can make arguments. Oh, okay, yeah. Well, it takes a gutsy deep earth scientist to make a statement about a strong unequivocal fact about the deep earth.